Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
And now, prepare yourself for the only talk radio show you'll want to turn up.
Crank this thing.
Sirius XM Pandora presents the place where your hard rock and metal voice can still be heard.
You bet your ass, baby.
Unfiltered, uncensored, say whatever you want.
Hit the record button. Anything can happen, you know?
I know that ain't nobody out there came to be mellow tonight, now did you? I say there ain't nobody. I'll say there ain't nobody not out there that even wants to be a little bit mellow now, is there? Anybody wants to get mellow, you can turn around and get the fuck out of here, all right?
This is the Trunk Nation Podcast with host Eddie Trunk.
What's up, everybody? It's Eddie Trunk, and welcome to another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast. New episodes every Thursday, wherever you get your podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you do not miss one. And thank you for listening, however, wherever you are in the world doing so. It is greatly appreciated. As I tell you every week, and we'll tell you once again this week, everything you hear on the Eddie Trunk Podcast, outside of this open, originated on my Sirius XM radio show, Trunk Nation. Heard live Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 Eastern, Faction Talk, Sirius XM Channel 103, or live or anytime on demand on the Sirius XM app. If you're in the U.S. or Canada and you only listen to this podcast, you're only getting a tiny, tiny taste of what I do on the radio live every weekday. So please come on board and join us and get involved and listen every day either on the app or to it over the air on 103. And truly, truly get involved in the show and do not miss a thing. We appreciate you doing so. And we got a way to make it very easy for you to sample Trunk Nation on Sirius XM that won't cost you a penny. You can get a free subscription. You can try it out for 3 months, totally free, and won't even ask you for a credit card. All you got to do is go to SiriusXM.com/Eddie Trunk. Again, that's SiriusXM.com/Eddie Trunk. Get your 3 free months. Listen on the app if you don't have a radio, or listen over the radio, whatever you'd like. And you can try out Trunk Nation for 3 months for free. And again, do no credit card required. SiriusXM.com/Eddie Trunk. This week on the podcast, something a little different. Usually I bring you interviews and parts of interviews that came out of a full show. This week we're pretty much going to bring you a full show from a couple weeks ago that I did in my Vegas studio with two old friends, Steve Brown and PJ Farley from the band Trickster. And let me give you the context here. So often on the radio show, I hear about and hear from listeners who are upset, or not upset, but talk about great records that came out once the scene changed post-Nirvana that were ignored. So in other words, 80s bands, predominantly, who put out records after Nevermind from Nirvana came out that were completely ignored because of the arrival of the whole grunge scene. We called it the Great Wall of Nirvana, meaning that when Nevermind came out, we all know like a gate dropped and suddenly everything before it was just considered uncool and cast out. Couldn't like it, couldn't be played, whatever. But there were a lot of bands that made really good records post Nevermind that have now gotten some new stature, like the Motley Crue record with Karabi, one of my favorites, Skid Row, Subhuman Race, many others. So we thought it would be fun to shine a spotlight on some of those records and bands. And Steve and PJ from Trickster, sitting in with me on this show, experienced that themselves. because their debut album came out and went like platinum and had a couple big hits. And by the time their second record came out, Nevermind came out and they were done. So they reflect a little bit about that with some stories. And we take calls from people with some of their favorite post-Nirvana records from bands from the 80s. Again, we called it the Great Wall of Nirvana. Going to pretty much bring you that entire show this week as the podcast, so you can get a little taste of some of the other stuff we do outside of traditional interviews, which, of course, are a big part of the show as well. So let's take you to my place in Vegas just a couple weeks ago. Steve and PJ from Trickster talking about some of the great 80s hard rock that was ignored and came out after Nevermind on this week's podcast. What we're going to talk about today is something that I get asked about a lot when we do open phones. And that is, we all know, as our friend Izzy Presley named this show today, the Great Wall of Nirvana, meaning that when 1991 hits, September 91 hits, Nevermind came out. We all know, I lived it. We all lived it. One of the most abrupt, unbelievably brutal changes where everything was like in one day wiped out in terms of what came before. And then everything was all about the Seattle world at that time. And so many good records came out post Nirvana, Nevermind, from 80s bands that hung in there and made albums. And unfortunately, it could have been the greatest record ever made. Didn't stand a chance in hell. Dead on arrival. Everybody's got stories about this. I can tell you a million of them being in radio and how that change happened and how abrupt and severe it was. You guys in Trickster lived it, and you lived it in a pretty, in one of the most cruel ways, meaning that, what I mean by that is,
I know what you mean.
First album came out what year?
90.
Okay. So here you guys are still super young kids when your first record came out, and you're chasing the dream. You get the record deal. First record comes out 1990, Give It To Me Good, hits MTV, hits radio, One in a Million, Surrender. Record goes what? Gold, platinum? Was
Gold
first record?
On its way to, should have been double platinum.
Silently platinum.
What is it now? What is the first album?
We have no real idea because, you know, sadly, we were in, Trickster was involved with possibly the worst record distribution in the history of record making.
But also, our record came out before SoundScan.
Yes.
So we got some sales.
Fuzzy math.
Yeah.
And so what is the record certified?
It's gold. Certified gold. But it's got to be well past a million by now as far as, but we'll probably never know that because of the whole the way everything MCA and Universal merged, and it was a fucking mess.
Okay. But the point of the matter is, records, debut record, extremely successful. MTV videos, you're out there on the road, everything's happening, you guys are 19 years old, whatever the hell you are, living the dream.
Yeah.
It's 1990, here we go. And then 91 happens. You make a second record called Here.
92.
But I'm talking in 91 happens for is Nirvana.
Yes.
Right.
91 is Nevermind, September 91. And that record comes out, and you're in the studio, I would imagine, at that point,
we're
making
still
your
riding,
second record.
We're still riding high into early October 91, out on tour with Warrant and Firehouse. And we told you the story last night, we played in L.A., and we went to visit Geffen Records, our old A&R guy, and just to raid the closet, get some CDs and stuff. So we go over there, and he goes, oh, you got to hear this, Nirvana, it's this new band that's coming out. And, you know, long story short, we get the T-shirts and the CDs and everything. What the hell is this?
This is the band that's going to end your career.
I feel like we walked away, we robbed a bank, we had the sack of money, and the ink blew. Because that's exactly what happened.
No, the getaway car.
Yeah, boom. All of a sudden, we're covered in pink paint.
I've told this story numerous times, how sort of, and I wish PJ, because back in the day, PJ was the guy, him and his brother would always have the video cameras. I wish more than anything that we had this on footage, you know, on video, because how ironic was it that here we are, you know, Warrant, Trickster, Firehouse, we're finishing up our Blood, Sweat, and Beers tour, Universal Amphitheater, sold out October of 91. We had a hugely successful, you know, our tour was 13 months from September of 1990 till October of 1991. We go to visit Bill Bennett, God rest his soul, who is our radio guy, broke us at MCA. He became the president of Geffen. He plays us Nirvana and gives us all the stuff. And we're walking back to the Riot House, the Hyatt on Sunset, with the Nirvana swag, you know, the ultimate hard 80s hard rock kids and the new kids on the block of rock, with the band, carrying the band, along with Guns N' Roses, Tesla.
Carrying the band that's going to end us.
End us.
Unbeknownst to you.
And everybody. And every other band.
Unbeknownst to you. You were literally carrying the bomb that was about to detonate.
Totally.
It was the perfect crime.
Yeah.
On Sunset Boulevard of all
Kurt
places.
Kurt Cobain pulled the chute on Cloud Nine for us.
So we're going to take calls from the audience, and our lines are jammed because the audience and I have talked about so many of these bands like yourself and others. And why I said for Trickster it was incredibly cruel is because bands that put out their first record, 83, 84, they had 7-8 years before The Wall came.
Yes.
You guys debut, because you're younger, your debut hits in 90. Okay, you have that year of like, year and a half of like MTV
Bliss.
And you're cool. Yeah, you're cool. You're on the radio. Yeah. It's great. It's fun. Then the gate comes down while you're making the second record here.
Yes.
Here, when the second record came out when? What year?
October 92. Of 1992.
So did you know, like, did you, okay, October 92. So that's about a year. At that point, Nirvana's humming. Like, that's happening.
Nirvana, Pearl Jam,
Alice I'll tell you this.
Chains.
We had
Did you
no
have
clue.
Any feel like that,
not
holy shit, no matter what we do in the studio right now, as a follow-up, is going to be DOA?
We were so oblivious and so ensconced in what we were doing, we didn't know it was over until we got on the Kiss Tour, and we went for ads for Road of 1,000 Dreams, the first singles, and every day, me and Steve would call our manager, how many ads did we get? And the numbers were dismal. They're like, guys, this isn't looking good. Every station we're going after is changing formats every single day. It's like, oh, we just changed literally yesterday. It was impossible to get ads. And we realized really quick that the end was near.
You were opening for Kiss on the Revenge Tour.
Yes.
Right.
And and that's the thing about this wall coming down that people don't realize. Even a band like Kiss, who were legendary, obviously, for already well into their career, it didn't discriminate. It wiped everything.
And they made one of the best records of their career.
With Revenge, right.
Yeah.
How did you guys handle that? Were you dumbfounded, devastated, hurt, angry? Like, what was the feeling about it?
I mean,
the
luckily,
time?
We've always had a good head on our shoulders and a good sense of humor. We always said, hey, and we still say it now when we're sitting in a car for 11 hours, hey, man, we're just happy to be here. We'd always say, we're one bed song away from working at a 7-Eleven or something. And always, you know, just kind of taking every day for what it is and appreciating
yes.
it. And we knew that it could end at any point. You know, did we want it to? No, but I think
You guys so quick because you got the bite of the apple.
You got the taste.
But you got the tiny taste, but then the wall came crashing because the timing. Who knew the timing? If your first record came out in 86, you might have squeezed out 3 records.
I'll tell you why I think we
definitely would have.
I'll tell you why I think we benefited the most out of that. Being that we were so young, we didn't find ourselves at 40 years old going, oh, shit, what do we do now? You know, we were really young when we were kind of, as I like to say, when we were forced to, you know, pull back into the blue garage and close the door for a little bit. And so Steve and I became super creative and active and recording and writing. And I don't know, I think we benefited from the fact that we were kind of forced into retirement and we upped our game creatively.
Retirement at 22.
It wasn't retirement, yeah. But getting back to it, more importantly, is the record here that, you know, so after the success of the first album, we were able to do a great thing. We had a great lawyer and our managers. We did a thing with MCA Records called renegotiation because we had a terrible contract and we renegotiated with MCA Records and we got $1 million to do our second record. It was kind of because they fucked us so much on, you know, again, Trickster owned MTV from, October of 1990 through June. And little known fact, Trickster Surrender, last video ever played on Dial MTV. So,
oh, wow.
At so number one, by the
way. At number one. Wow. So that's another thing. And anybody that knows anything, and like John Kolodner told our managers back in, the, you know, when this was all, if you were on Geffen Records, you would have sold 3 million records. And right. It's true because, true. The you know.
MCA touring... stood for Musician Cemetery of America.
We were number one on MTV. We had a hit song. Yeah. We'd go into the record stores in the mall and they wouldn't have it.
Yeah. That was trying to sell this thing, right? Give It to Me Good was number one and we were blowing up. We were in Ohio, which is where Ohio and Florida were the two states that really broke Trickster back. I remember vividly, we were in this mall and we went to three record stores. It was when a mall had actually three record stores. Only one of them had our record.
And it was and not because it was sold out.
Yeah.
Just they didn't have stock.
But
right.
Getting into the here aspect, we signed this huge record deal, which was incredible because I went out with my manager to do the deal and do the renegotiation. And the next day I went up to 5150 and, you know, it was a very surreal experience later in the day that I called my parents and I said, Mom and Dad, I have some great news. We signed this great new record deal. We're going to be on MCA. We got $1 million, $500,000 to do the record, $500,000 advance. So we all got some money. We all got paid, you know, as we like to get in the music business. And, you know, my parents were like, man, that's really cool. And the other thing is, like, I went up to Eddie Van Halen's house and got to play all his guitars today. And that was, like, a very surreal moment.
Yeah, of course.
In its sense. Yeah. But we made this great record. And like PJ said, we were living in the Trickster bubble, which I think any band that you talk to who was in this time, we were all kind of oblivious to what's going on because we were so ensconced in making what we considered and what we wanted to be our greatest record. And this record that was going to sell 10 million records.
Right. Yeah. And the Great Wall came down and crashed down on you and everybody else. So that's
segue.
So that's what we're going to talk about today. And we're going to turn it over to you now. Maybe Trickster Here is one of your favorite post-Nirvana records. Could be a lot. I mean, for me, as everybody knows, I love Skid Row's Subhuman Race. That was 95. Didn't stand a chance, but an amazing record. I love Extremes, Waiting for the Punchline, a really cool record. I got a funny quick story about that, just because, you know, having been in radio through all that, I saw everything. Steve was saying he knew it was over for the second record because MTV declined to add your video.
Oh my God. I remember we were backstage. I think Gene Simmons was talking to somebody and I remember our manager Joel walking up to us and saying, dude, I got bad news. MTV's not adding the Road of a Thousand Dreams video. I was basically, we looked at each other. Like PJ
said,
that was the kill shot.
That's when you know it's over. I mean, and one quick story from me before we go to the phones, I was working at my local rock station in Jersey, and I was doing a regular shift, but I also was doing the metal thing on the weekend. And I got asked if Nuno and Gary could come in from Extreme. And I said, of course, because I love those guys. And they had this record, Waiting for the Punchline. So whatever that was, 93 or whatever. And they come in and I'm on the air live in the afternoon when they show up in the lobby. And the program director at the time, I said, oh, you know, tell him to come right in. I'll put him on. And he comes over and he goes, no. He goes, we're not putting him on live on the air in the middle of the afternoon. I go, why not? He goes, no, we don't do that anymore here. Not for that band. I was like, what? I go, what do you mean? What are we doing then? And he goes, well, take him in the back in the production studio and pre-record an interview, and then you can edit up a little section of it and play it in your show on the weekend if you want on your metal show. So it was like humiliating because I'm on the air live, and I'm like, I can't just have them come in and say, hey, what's up? Like, 2 years earlier, More Than Words is friggin' in power rotation.
They like, got what downgraded.
And it's like, yeah, so it's like, no, take him to the back. Like, hide them.
Oh,
take
him
in the back in the production studio.
There's a service elevator. Exactly. Service elevator back there.
Let me give a little cautionary note to anybody out there in a band. If you go to a radio station and do an interview and you aren't put on the air live at the time the station's on the air, there's a pretty good chance your interview is going to be edited to 30 seconds and maybe not air anywhere ever at all. Yeah. Or it might end up on their podcast or their website or whatever, because that's the move. It's like, you don't want to say no to seem cruel, but if you can it, well, nobody really knows if it ever really airs. You know, it'd be like if we were doing this right now and recording it versus being live, and then you guys leave and I'll take a 30-second clip and tomorrow, hey, Stephen PJ from Trickster, we're here, and, you know, put it out, you know. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on, but I always remember that Extreme story, and I was standing there and I felt so bad, and I'm like, no guys, we're not going in that studio, come back here. And then we went in the back, you know, where they were cutting tape and doing production. I'm like, here, just do this mic, tell me about the record real quick.
Did Nuno have his beard at that point? The beard one? But hey, let's give a shout out to Nuno and the Extreme guys. Their killer new record,
yeah,
man.
I love it. So happy
for them.
I love it. They're on
love
tour right
dudes.
Now they're playing in Jersey, actually. We're here, but they're there. I got it. And those guys texted me for my birthday, which I appreciate. It was very nice. All right, so let's hear the records from you guys right now. We go to the phones. We start in San Antonio, Charlie in Texas. Go ahead, Charlie.
Hey, Ed, PJ, Steve. Good to talk to you guys.
Hey, man.
Ed, real quick, I would love to hear you do this again and focus on the concert experiences from the 92 to 96 era, because there's some pretty good stories there. But my pick today is Shotgun Messiah's Second Coming, which came out a month after the Nirvana album hit. It's such a great album, and such great guitar work, and Tim Skold is on that album. And that's my pick, man. I know you got a lot of callers, so y'all have a good day, and I appreciate the time.
Thanks, Charlie. Yeah, Tim Skold is still around. He just played the Whiskey in L.A. last week. I was there, and he's doing his own thing, I guess. But Shotgun Messiah, I mean, that band never a lot of the bands we're going to talk about today had a gold platinum record before. That band never really got popular, but that record obviously got
when
killed.
Was Heartbreak Boulevard, that was before that,
that was before probably. That but when we were making here, we were living out in LA, we were living the rock star life. We went to see Shotgun Messiah at the Whiskey for the Heartbreak Boulevard record, man. I remember it was me,
was
you, Dave Bryan from Bon Jovi was recording their record, you know, Keep the Faith at that point too, at the same time
that's a great example.
Great record.
I love Keep the Faith is among my best, my favorite Bon Jovi records. Yep. And that record obviously was, you know, John cut his hair. He tried. Mm-hmm. Right at that time, John offered me a job working for his label.
Yep. Jamco.
And they didn't know if they were going to even hold that band together. I remember he said to me, I'm going to St. Thomas to see if I still have a band. And when I come back, I'll let you know and we'll talk about doing this. He made me offer money and everything to work for this label he was doing, Jamco.
Yeah.
And when he came back, the whole bottom fell out on the label, and he was, even a guy as big as that was kind of struggling. He made that solo album, Destination Anywhere, at that time too, which I loved. These Days was around that time, that Bon Jovi record.
That was the next record. Yeah. But I mean, you know,
The point is, it affected every level. People took hits.
Yep. Shots fired, hitting everybody.
Here's Rocco in Indiana. What's up, Rocco?
How you doing, Eddie? I'm sorry, I'm hard of hearing. Your guest that's sitting there with you, what's his name?
Yeah, Stephen PJ.
How you doing?
How you doing, man?
How are you, brother?
I'm doing good. Getting ready to go to work, which I don't feel like doing, but I'm here. So, anyway. I didn't have a whole lot of time to do this. We have a supervisor named Mark. He's a heavy metal nut. And I told him what you were doing today. And he suggested Enough's Enough. I did a quick research. And an album that I feel was destroyed by this, by those guys, I would say the album they came out with in 93 called Animals with Human Intelligence. Mm-hmm. It seems like that album didn't do good. And I would say that album got destroyed by Nirvana. I don't know what you guys.
Yeah,
think.
Tell
me what you guys. Think.
Well, the second Enough's Enough record was called Strength. Thank you, Rocco. It was called Strength,
yes.
I think.
Yeah.
And that would have been pre-Nirvana. That because the first album was what, 89?
No.
It was like Strength, I think, came out in 91, like early 91.
Guys, look up for me what year Enough's Enough.
I don't know.
Oh,
so.
That
I think
came
that came out.
Out
early 92, I want to say. I could
because
be
that could be Strength. So Strength, we're looking a lot at the records that were right after, you know, the ones right after the first one.
And Animals with Human Intelligence is 93.
Yeah.
So, but what does it say? What month in 91?
No, I don't have the month here. Hang tight.
March 26, 1991.
So it was before, okay. Yeah. But it was about, they had about a 5-6 month window. I don't know why Enough's Enough didn't, they could have just got in under the wire there. Here's Dave in Maryland. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, guys. I got a couple. I'll hit you real fast. First one is actually came out in 97, but it was Night Rangers Neverland. It's their comeback album with original members, and it's as good, if not better, than the first three, and it just died without a trace.
Didn't there was the chance. Record. There was the night. There was a Night Ranger record. I don't know if it was Neverland. I think it was one earlier than that that I liked a lot around that time too. But I do remember having that record. What was
the other one? Was Feeding Off the Mojo that they put out without Jack
Gary Lee, Moon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Gary Moon. Great album, band, right?
Different.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
The other one, you know, hit you real quick is this a little odder, but the last record of the '80s lineup of Heart, called Desire Walks On. It was a much heavier album than what they had been doing, and it's really great, but same thing. This came out in 93, and you heard nothing. It just died.
Yeah. Thank you, Dave. The other thing that comes to mind was a classic story with Warrant, because Warrant made a record at that time called Doggy Dog, which is way heavy, like Machine Gun, Hole in My Wall. And there was that story where I think Janie Lane went to the label at Columbia to meet with people about setting up the record, and where there was always a big Cherry Pie poster behind the receptionist's desk. It had been changed to an Alice in Chains facelift poster, and he literally saw the writing on the wall. It was over, despite they went with Michael Wagner and they made a real heavy record. Another one that comes to mind for me is there's a Saigon Kick record called Water, and it's the first record where Jason Bieler actually sings all the lead vocals, but I always loved that record. I thought it was a cool record, but didn't stand a chance. Darren in Pittsburgh. Go ahead, Darren.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My pick is slightly before Nirvana. I want to say maybe a month or so before it came out, but it's L.A. Guns, Hollywood Vampires. I thought that was a great album, Over the Edge, Kiss My Love Goodbye.
Does it qualify?
Amongst others. Pardon me?
Well, it came out a month before Nirvana?
Yeah, just right before.
That's all right, though, because how much are you going to get done in a month before the gate came down?
Yeah. But when Nirvana came out, it didn't
it took
change
a couple
the world
months.
Yeah. Right then and there. It took a couple months.
Right. So you're allowing LA Guns or not, PJ?
I think LA Guns, yeah, I don't know. I think unbeknownst to Nirvana.
The record, the LA Guns record that a lot of people tell me they love, and I don't really know it all that well, but they say it's super heavy too. I think it's called Vicious Circle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And people say that's a great record. Mike Piazza loves that record. I just talked to Mike the other day. I never spent time with that record, but people swear by that record. So, all right. Thank you, Darren. Appreciate it. Love Hate, another band that could have been huge, actually, but timing, even though Love Hate, I think, was to me, bands like Love Hate and Saigon Kick were kind of like bridge bands.
Yes.
They had elements of the 80s stuff, but they also were almost ahead of their time in some of the things they were doing with what was coming. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter what you look like. It was just like the gate. I always joke with you guys, like, you were wearing flannel in the Give It To Me Good video.
Mm-hmm.
You were, fashion-wise, you were trendsetters.
Well, Milo, you know,
we were the band.
The grunge bands ripped you guys, tripped up tricksters. Look
at Nirvana's video, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit. They were in a gymnasium with people jumping around. We were in a garage.
Yeah.
It's like I always say, all those bands from Seattle took our flannels and hung us with them.
That's right.
Here's Johnny Mack in Johnny, where are you at, Johnny? Where are you calling? Tennessee. Go ahead, Johnny.
I'm calling from Big Sandy, Tennessee.
Welcome to the show. What are we calling this? Post Nirvana wall or whatever? What's your record?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you. You know, I was 14 about the time that this came out, that Here came out, and I was kind of oblivious to the kind of music that I like going on the downswing, because I was just reading Metal Edge and Hit Parader and shit, and they still had full page ads for the, you know, for Here and Dog Eat Dog and all that. So I thought business was usual, you know. But anyway, so I remember the first time I heard Teen Spirit on the radio, and I couldn't stand it. I thought it was terrible. I had to go listen to Motley Crue to cleanse my ears, you know. But But after that, I got here on cassette because I was going to the Kiss concert on the Revenge Tour in Nashville. And I did my homework. So the first band I ever saw play, a rock band in concert, was Trickster. And,
nice.
Because they kicked that show off in, at the Municipal Auditorium there. And, man, yep. It was awesome. And I've been hooked on concerts ever since. But so anyway, here, definitely one of my favorite albums that fits
Love
the topic
it.
We're talking about. Rockin' Horse and What It Takes are my two favorite tunes off of it.
Nice.
But oh, also, you know, there you go. About Dog Eat Dog a lot, but nobody ever mentions Warrant Ultraphobic and Belly to Belly that came out after them, and they were great too,
oh, yeah.
Man. They have some mm-hmm. other baddest ass songs were on those records, you know?
Yeah.
And,
of course. Thank you, Johnny. Thanks for calling
Thanks,
in.
Thanks, Johnny.
Of course, when it comes to this topic, a record that gets a ton of attention from a lot of fans is the Corabi Motley Crue record, mm-hmm. which was, what, 94, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, John always jokes, yeah, I'm the guy who ruined Motley Crue. But you could make the case that even if Vince was still there, the same fate would have been for that record at that time for Motley Crue. But people love, like, that Corabi record has all new stature now. People love that record.
We love that, man. I had just built my studio when that record came out, and we were working on new. We were doing the Throwing Rock stuff. We were doing the Trickster Undercovers. Mm-hmm. And I remember putting that on Hooligan's Holiday that first time I heard that in my studio, cranking up. Still, to this day, I still think it's one of the best Motley records they ever made, you know.
But Call you're right. You're right. Even if Motley was original,
it wouldn't matter.
It wouldn't have mattered. And you know what? They made a great fucking record.
Yeah,
love that record.
Yeah, yeah. Wouldn't have mattered though. That's the sad part.
Yeah.
Here's Brian in Minnesota. Go ahead, Brian.
Hey guys, thanks for having me on here. Hey, a couple for you that might jog your memory. Scorpions, Face the Heat came out in 1993 and just did nothing compared to the previous album, Crazy World, which of course had their biggest song.
Winter Change. Right.
And the other one that came to my mind was Great White, Psycho City, possibly their best album. And again, that one just died. So many good songs on that one.
Yeah, two good ones there. I also just came to mind was Slaughter Wildlife. Because that, thank you, Brian. I remember that. That had some great songs on it. That was following up the huge debut record and all that. And I'm pretty sure Wildlife probably hit like 91-ish. And same deal.
It's,
I mean,
still got a little bit of steam.
A little bit,
but
yeah, not much.
Yeah.
My favorite record still to this day from, you know, again, the post-Nirvana and all of us getting wiped out, Winger Pull.
Yeah.
Winger, that Winger record, that's when they were working with Mike Shipley from Def Leppard.
Yep.
I still use that record as some of the songs, Blind Revolution, Mad, Junkyard Dog, as reference tracks when I mix songs in my studio. Great.
Isn't Down Incognito's
down
on there?
Down Incognito.
He still does that actually live. That is a great record.
But that record, if you haven't heard that, you rockers out there, give
it
a listen.
What about the Bullet Boys, Freak Show?
I don't know that record, but that would certainly qualify.
That had cool. THC on it.
Yeah,
THC
was,
that was a badass.
There was some cool shit on that record.
Yeah,
really
I know that song. I don't know that record top to bottom.
Yeah.
What about the, what year was this? No, it would have been earlier. The second Faster Pussycat would have been way earlier because the first album was 87.
No, they came out with another one around maybe 90.
Because there's 94? some of these records got so buried, I didn't even know they came out.
Yeah,
like, you don't even know they exist.
Yep.
I'll go into, like, Amoeba or something in L.A. and flip through the used bins and, like, wait a minute, they put out a record in 93? Like, it was so buried, you didn't even know. It's nuts. Here's Brent in Idaho joining us now. Hey, Brent.
Hey, Eddie, thank you for taking my call. Hey,
Thank you, man.
Speaking of Winger, dude, Winger not only got destroyed by Beavis and Butthead, but then they got destroyed again by Nirvana, those poor guys. I love them.
Metallica, really.
Who, by the way, I don't know if people know this or picked up on this, but this has come up a couple times in the press, and Kip actually first ever said this right on this show, and I was really surprised when he said it because it kind of flew under the radar, surprisingly, a little bit at that time. But he has since revealed this. James Hetfield has reached out recently to Kip and apologized to him for the Nothing Else Matters video and throwing the dart, which Kip said to me, it's nice that James is calling me. He goes, but Lars was the one throwing the dart. Yeah. But still, James, you know, James is a guy that's, you know, in recovery and, yep, and whatever. And I guess part of that process is kind of like making amends with people. But I guess that bothered him. Yeah. And he went and reached out and is now in touch and has talked to Kip on more than one occasion. And I told Kip what they should have done is when Metallica did that record where they had 50 artists or whatever cover their songs, they should have had Kip cover a
Metallica
song. That would have
been great,
like,
man.
Because he could do orchestration, like nothing else matters
or
something.
Totally, he would have killed it.
And it would have been such a cool button on that story to put an end to it. Like, here's Winger on a Metallica covers record sanctioned by Metallica. But class act for James to reach out to Kip about that decades later. Go ahead, Brent. What else did you want to say?
Okay, so I got two albums for you. Number one, the first Saigon Kick record, 1991. That should have done a lot better, and I think maybe that got curtailed by Nirvana. Their
was
second
that
album, The Lizard.
Well, hold on. Wait a minute. Was that 91 the debut?
First Saigon Kick record was 91.
Look that up for us, guys. Give me the date on that if you can. The self-titled Saigon Kick, and then
The Lizard was the second record.
But The Lizard had a number one hit on it.
The Lizard did a lot better.
Yeah,
The Lizard did a lot better, but that was because of Love Is on the Way.
92.
Right.
That was 92.
Yep.
Yeah, we're gonna get the dates straight on this.
Love Saigon Kick.
So February 91. Brent, February 91 is the release date on the debut Saigon Kick record.
Yep.
So that gets out.
Doesn't qualify.
Right, because that's out 6 months before Nevermind, at least. So that got in. That did okay. I remember What You Say was on that, and I love that record. And then The Lizard comes out in June of 92, so that is post The Wall. But against all odds, Saigon Kick has a huge hit with an acoustic ballad.
So there's, and to touch on this, there's a theme here with Saigon Kick, a band that really, that record wouldn't have seen the light of day. It would have got squashed like everyone else's, but it had the ballad hit, just like Extreme had the ballad hit, just like Mr. Big had the ballad hit, and the Scorpions had the ballad hit. They all made it through that, you know, tumultuous time.
But Extreme and all those guys, that was before Nirvana.
So
Porno Graffiti was before.
Yeah,
Mr. Big was all before.
That was
the oddity is Saigon Kick.
No, but Lean Into It came out early 91. To Be With You didn't hit till well after.
Yeah, late.
By the way, speaking of Mr. Big, there's people to this day that don't know, but Mr. Big made two records in the mid-90s with Richie Kotzen on guitar instead of Paul Gilbert because Paul left the band, and they're both really good records, but completely off the radar. Even though they came out on Atlantic in the U.S., completely off the radar here because of what was happening at the time. But there's those records. And speaking of Kotzen, there's a lot of people that love the Poison album that he did, Native Tongue.
I was going to say
that. And that was probably like, 93 or something?
Yeah.
That had Stand on it and all that, which I thought was amazing, you know? So that's another one that you could throw out there.
That was one of the mistakes that I think with the Trickster, that if I have one thing that I could change about that, and I know there's not many things I could change about the Here record, the marketing of it, we should have, remember how Peter Mensch always said, never go down with the ballad? We should have released, we have a great ballad on the Here record called As the Candle Burns. We should have released that and went to CHR Radio, not even try to compete.
Forget rock.
Follow
the theme,
that could have been an interesting.
It was supposed
there.
To be the third single, but we MCA cut the money off.
Jeff in Palm Springs, go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, Eddie, PJ, Steve, can you hear me okay?
Yep,
we got you.
What's up, brother?
Hey, thanks. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. So let me just say that Trickster should have been huge. That album Here, that album is so good. The song Rockin' Horse, I put it on every playlist I make to this day.
Awesome.
That song resonated with me. You guys should.
This show is going to make Here go platinum today.
Yes, that's it.
We're going to rechart Here 40 years later.
People are finally going to hear Here.
Well, that's what I say during the acoustic show. I say that, you know, Trickster Here is our Dark Side of the Moon, our Sergeant Pepper. Nobody knows that, though. It's just we in our minds. So.
Yeah. I'm one of those people, though, that I was a fan from day one. I bought that album from
day one. You know, and I'm going to say this, Nirvana sucks. They really do. You know, back when Nirvana first came out, I just thought to myself, Kurt Cobain, he's like the worst singer I've ever heard. And I try to listen to their music. I try to listen to their music now and see if it's any good to me, if it changes the way I feel. And it sounds dated to me. It really, really does. That's just my opinion. You know, I think only
well,
two
you're entitled
really
to your opinion.
I think that there were only really two good bands that came out from that whole Seattle scene, Soundgarden and Alice in Chains, you know, and that's it for me. You know, so as far as my list goes, I'll run it down really fast for you. Cinderella, Still Climbing. Fast and Pussycat, Whipped.
Yep.
Living
we
Color,
got a date on Whipped. Staining. We just let me jump in real quick there. Whipped was 92, so that was after, but the follow-up to the first album was Wake Me When It's Over, which had House of Pain on it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in under the gate, but Whipped was the record after the gate, the third record.
Living Color, Stain. I think they're touring on the anniversary of that right now. That album was so good.
Oh, wow.
Motley Heavy Crue, record. Of course. Motley Crue, the John Corabi record. Poison, Native Tongue. That's the only Poison record I can listen to without skipping any songs. Skid Row, Subhuman Race. That was the best record they ever made. Rat made a self-titled record that came out in 1999. Tesla, Bust a Nut. Oh, my God.
Bust a Nut's a good one. I love that record. Yeah. Terry Thomas produced it. Yeah, sounds amazing.
Yeah. Wasp made probably the heaviest record they've ever made called Kill, Fuck, Die. It got buried in the 90s.
I remember that. KFD was on the cover. It said KFD.
Yeah. Yep.
Kill
Warrant, Dog Eat Dog from Warrant. I got to see Janie before he passed away. That was so awesome. You know what I mean? And, you know, I'm proud to say that I was into all of these albums from day one. You know, and I went to some shows in the 90s where the places were half empty, and it was really, really sad. So I'm glad you guys are still around and still doing what you do. Everybody listening, check out everything Trixer did after the first record, because you guys are so talented and should be. You guys should be in the same conversation as Def Leppard. You really should. I'm just saying. You know, people need to know.
Thank
about
you,
it.
Man.
Thank you,
that's
Jeff.
Thank you, man. That means a lot.
They should be, but they don't travel that way. I had to pick them both up at the airport yesterday and jam them in the back of my Toyota Corolla. Yep. So that's how they roll. Def Leppard's in their private plane.
What did we say before? We're just happy to be here. 33 years later, we're still getting to fly all around the world and rock and roll. We're in Vegas playing Trixie songs.
Of course, man.
We won the game.
You guys always have the great attitude about it, which is awesome. Let's say hi to... This is our buddy Tim in Florida.
All right.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Hey Tim, what's up,
Tim? AKA Thinking Stanley.
I knew it. I knew it was coming. By the way, Tim, these guys at dinner last night showed me your birthday video that you made for me, which I had not seen. It is brilliant, and I thank you.
Well, I sent him the one that you sent me. I showed him the new one that you sent yesterday.
The impression, the impersonation is mind-blowing, dude.
It was.
Whoever did that.
Yes.
I've heard a lot of Paul Stanley impressions. I have never heard one that good.
Yep.
That's AI. That's AI. That's nobody.
That's what I thought.
Is it really?
That's what AI can do. I'm staying away from that stuff. That's dangerous. But,
man, I mean, that is just scary to know how much impersonation and misrepresentation can be done out there in technology today. That's you got to be so careful.
Now, was the first
you
one
see, read, believe.
Was that first one that you sent me? The one I texted him your birthday message. That was you, right?
Yeah, that's Thinking Stanley. Yeah, that's Thinking Stanley. Okay. That's my voice.
That's the one I texted you on your birthday. This one was his buddy who did the AI one.
Yeah.
Oh, so unbelievable.
So Tim, what's your record here?
I'm gonna go with Bang Tango, second album, Dancing on Coals.
All right.
Don't know that record. I don't know that band beyond like the single or two from that first record. But that was a band you could easily make a case was kind of ahead of its time too, because they were kind of like that groove, Faith No More-ish sort of vibe at times.
Kind of like that band White Trash.
With the horns, Apple Pie. They had that hit. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Tim.
Hey, and before I get off here, I got to tell your listeners, hey. Go check out Trixter Acoustic. It is awesome. These guys sing so freaking great together. It blew my mind. I did not realize how well these guys sang live, harmonizing together, just the two of them. It's phenomenal, seriously.
But what would happen if you found out that it was a laptop and it's a track and they're not even really doing it? I watched them working on the tracks before they got here. They're tuning them up for tonight.
Oh, man. You know it. Well, thank you, Tim. Yeah, Tim was at our show a couple weeks ago down in Florida. We love you, bro. Rock and roll.
Thank you, pal.
Real musicians actually playing and singing real instruments into real mics. What a friggin' concept.
In the original keys.
Yeah, what a concept. Here's Dave in Buffalo. Go ahead, Dave.
Hey, hey, PJ. Hey, Steve.
Hey, buddy.
Hey,
how are you?
I got two. Steve, I know Steve a little bit. We've done some work together recently. But one is the Trickster album for sure here. Definitely my favorite. A great album. The other one, though, it may be a transition band, I'm not sure how you consider, is the first Brother Kane album, which came out around 92 or 93, had Got No Shame on it. I thought that was a great one, and it should have been better.
And Full Shine. Was And Full Shine on the first one, too?
Yep.
I think so.
Was that was you say that was their first record?
Yep.
The debut had Got No Shame.
That was, you're right. I think that I consider that a transition band.
It's kind of more of a blues rock.
Because,
blues,
you know what, band. We're kind of talking about bands that were out before the wall, and then still trying to survive after the wall fell. Brother Kane came out after the wall.
Yeah, the debut Brother Kane record. You guys look. Let me know a date on that if you can. But actually, two of the guys, Damon and one of the other original guys, is doing Brother Kane again. Yep. They're going out playing. Damon's in Skynyrd now.
Yes,
and they Skynyrd has downtime, and Damon's going to go out and do a run of dates.
And Buck Johnson.
Buck plays keys.
Buck is in it.
Tony Higbee's in it.
Love
Jared Pope.
Tony. It's incredible.
Two of the Kiefer guys. Yeah, it's a great band.
We love that Brother Kane record.
Brother Kane came out in '93.
Yeah.
May of '93. Dave.
Should have been bigger though, for sure.
Yeah. But I mean, it came out. Dave. It was a pretty big record. It was well after the fact. I mean, they had the benefit of being looked at as a new band without a history. The problem was your history worked against you.
So they blurred the line because they were a pretty organic, just regular rock band.
Right.
It wasn't a grunge band. It was one of the first waves of just rock and roll, not shoegazer. It wasn't, you know, just a fun rock band.
Right. We'll get one more and then we'll take a break and then we'll continue. What we're doing is talking about records from essentially 80s bands that the gate known as Nirvana Nevermind came down. The scene changed. Everybody got wiped away, but some still made really good records that were sadly really, really overlooked and buried. Mark in Texas is going to call in with his record or his thoughts. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, hey, Eddie, and by the way, Steve, I am going to check out those guitars. That sounds very interesting. All right, 97 and 98, one guy already said the feeding off the mojo on the Night Ranger. I also will add they did an album in 97 called Neverland, and they did one in 98 called Seven, which were the last two albums with the original lineup, and they got nowhere. Very unheard of. I think they did a live album off of one of those albums in Japan. Like you were saying yesterday, Eddie, everybody does Japan or alternate songs in Japan.
But, we did.
those two Night Ranger albums didn't get any love at all. And I heard one of the guys say about his favorite two 90s bands. I'd also add, I think mine had to be STP maybe, but they were just fantastic. And a little asterisk for a band. Not hard rock, but the Tubes came out in the mid 90s with an album called Genius of America that's very good and didn't get anything. Anyway, thank you guys. Great show, Eddie. Great 40th.
Thank you, Mark.
Keep it rocking.
Thank you, man. Appreciate your thoughts.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Price drop? Time to shop. Get to a Nordstrom Rack store today for first dibs on new markdowns. Now score even more, up to 70% off brands everyone loves at Nordstrom Rack. Denim, dresses, sneakers, tops, and more. Plus, get genius deals on jackets, sweaters, and boots for the whole family. Shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and save up to 70% with new markdowns. But hurry, deals this great won't last.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable. But the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
Interesting times here, talking about not a great time for 80s rock bands, but kind of going down memory lane and remembering some of these stories and some of these great records. You know, one that didn't come up is a band that Steve Brown, as we talked about earlier, has worked with recently as a sub guitar player in Def Leppard, and that's the Slang Record. I like the Slang Record a lot.
Great.
And that record didn't stand a chance. And that was, so when this all went on, you had bands that approached it two different ways. Stay in the lane and do what everybody knows them for sound-wise, or try to adapt to what was going on at the time. Mm-hmm. And that's what Def Leppard did. They definitely got a little darker and less produced and stripped down with Slang. But I thought it was a cool record, and I liked it. When bands tried doing that, a lot of people thought it was like desperate and, oh, that's not their sound. But in some cases, it worked. I like the Slang Record. I remember hearing Work It Out, which is Vivian Campbell's first record with the band, and the first song he wrote with the band was Work It Out.
Which was a bold move for them.
And that was the lead single.
Love that song.
And the video was cool. And But as they'll tell you, they couldn't get... That's a band as big as Def Leppard. Didn't matter. Couldn't get arrested with it. Kiss tried to go grunge, obviously, with Carnival of Souls, which didn't work and led to the reunion. But still, there's elements of that record I actually kind of like. Here is Mitch, who's in Missouri. Go ahead, Mitch.
Hey, Eddie.
Hey, Mitch, go ahead, man. You're on the air. Yep, we got you.
Hey. Okay. Yeah, by the way, a little off subject, but New Audio Machine and Human Error are two great Trickster albums that have came out in like the last 10 years that people ought to check out.
They're way Thank after you. The wall.
Yeah,
but,
yes.
But still, they could still suffer from the wall just from preconceived thoughts and people not listening to them objectively.
There was
so that's a good point.
Residual walls.
The wall still, trust me, the wall still exists. For people that don't, we're talking about this like the wall is long crumbled. There is still a lot of bias, if we're being honest, against a lot of these bands. You're all able to work and tour and play again, but there's still stuff that, like, you know, you put out a new record from what many of these bands and you send it to radio. It's like, oh, we'll put it in the weekend, you know, metal show or something. But
we don't even send it to radio. Like us nowadays, we make records because it's what we do. We have to write and record music. That's what we do. But we have no visions of grandeur. There's no talk of radio campaigns.
I'm going to say right now, I'm having done this my whole life. I'm very, very proud of the fact, and I can say this in full certainty, that during this whole thing going on, when it went through the 90s and all of these bands could not get arrested, I still was there playing and interviewing them. And I did not...
Living proof.
Yeah, and I still interviewed Soundgarden and Alice in Chains, the new bands at the time, but I still would interview Trickster or Extreme or whatever, or Rat. It didn't matter. I didn't fall into that trap, and it's not because even the industry got killed by it. If you were an A&R guy that signed bands like that, you couldn't get work. If you were a photographer known for shooting that kind of stuff, it was across the board.
Yeah.
Anyway, Mitch, go ahead with your bands.
Yeah. Okay. Well, mine, they actually had three albums that were great albums. King's X, but they had their self-titled album and Ear Candy, but my favorite one of the bunch that I think should have been huge was Dogman, because it was easily
I love Dogman.
Heaviest, and Ross.
Brendan O'Brien.
Yeah.
It was the first. It was the first time King's X worked with a different producer and Brendan O'Brien.
Yep. Yep. It was just a great album. And yeah. And by the way, I called you the other day on Bad. It should have been Huger. They've been together since 1980. And the first time I got to see them was 1984, long before they made it. But they're still killer live. They're just amazing.
Who are you talking about? King's X?
King's X, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, you know, there's a doc. Well, you're from Missouri. That's where their roots really originally are, as you probably know. But
yep. Oh, yeah.
All right, Mitch, thank you. Sorry, I didn't mean to clip you, but we got to move on. By the way, there is a King's X documentary coming out, which I was actually interviewed for. I saw a rough cut of it, so looking forward to that coming out and being finished. Here is Steve in Cleveland. Go ahead, Steve.
Hey, Eddie. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, PJ. Steve, how are you guys?
Hey, man. How you doing?
What's up, Steve?
Hey, since I've been on hold here, I think most of my albums have been named. A couple that stand out that I don't think I've heard yet is Three Sides by Extreme and Waiting for the Punchline. I thought both of those were great.
Well, Punchline, I said earlier. I think Three Sides was pre-Nirvana, wasn't it? Or was it
92.
After?
No, it was after. It was 92.
It was. Okay, so Three Sides, Extreme got some play with Rest in Peace on that record. They did kind of okay. Not nearly what the previous record was, but Three Sides was a really, like, they went on some trips on that record. There's some really jammy, epic stuff on there. But that's an interesting case in that they actually got a little love with Rest in Peace after Nirvana, but by the time Punchline hit, it was way over.
I think they were, they came off of that huge success of More Than Words.
It was still going
on.
More Than Words
was
still on the charts, I think, when they released
that
record.
They grandfathered in for that, but
for a brief moment.
Didn't last long.
Right.
And Bust a Nut and Native Tongue are still two albums that I listen to regularly. I think those are just, you know, well overlooked gems by those bands. Interestingly enough, I saw Tesla here locally a couple weeks ago, and I got to speak to Frank, and I said, "Is Shine Away gonna ever make the set list again, or was that just a Eddie Trunk special?" And he said that it's probably gonna make it back when they do their Vegas residency along with some others. So hopefully they'll pull a few more off of that album as well.
Yeah, I will get on them, Steve, about getting that back in. They did that for me, which was super nice, but that should be in there the whole time. And I told them it went over pretty well, too. They should put that in there, and they will mix it up when they play here in Vegas. And I miss them. Thank you, Steve. I miss them when they did the first run, but I will definitely be catching some of this run coming up, which is soon, like in a month and a half or 2 months or something like that. But yeah, Shine Away, Try So Hard on Bust a Nut is a great one. It's super tasty Tommy Scio guitar stuff in that. It's so good. And production-wise, I love the sound of it. They had never worked with Terry Thomas before who did that record. Here's Oren in New Jersey. Hi, Oren.
Hey, Eddie and all. First of all, great memory seeing Trickster open for Kiss. My brother Adam actually caught your drumstick, which was amazing. So thanks for that. For the records, I want to put another vote in for Still Climbing by Cinderella. And I do also want to call out the two by Dawkins, Dysfunctional and Shadow Life. I know these are not usually their best reviewed CDs, but I thought they were good. And with Shadow Life, they went in some interesting directions, trying to stay relevant. And lastly, I want to ask you to listen to a great song by the Smithereens called Sick of Seattle, because I think we were all sick of Seattle.
Great title.
Yeah, well, the other thing about it, and thank you, Oren, is there on Extreme's album, Waiting for the Punchline, the single was a song called Hip Today. And the chorus was, the chorus of the song is, you'll be gone tomorrow, you'll be gone tomorrow, you're just hip today, which, you know, I always took as a statement about what they were up against, you know, with a statement on those bands, you know, that all of a sudden they were so extreme, so uncool, but everyone's saying these other bands are cool. And the message was, well, they're hip today, but it's not going to so much last. But I remember that being the single at that time, which ties into another thing, like, you got, like, a lot of fans were angry when the Nirvana thing happened because their music was immediately told it was the music they grew up with the last 10 years was not cool, not hip, whatever. But bands handled it in different ways. Some of them were accepting of the new sound coming in and interested in it and kind of on board with it. Some of it were like, some bands were understandably pissed off and like had resentment towards it. Where did you guys land on it when you saw what was happening and you saw it was basically going to destroy your careers and you made a great record that didn't stand a chance because of it? Were you in some ways angry?
I, like I've touched on before, I think because we had the benefit of being so young still when, you know, when the roller coaster stopped, we came out of it at still a young age. We were still very much, as we are still now, full of piss and vinegar, that we were like, all right, well, look, it's only going to stop us briefly, you know, but we're going to do other things. And like I said, I mean, Steve and I continued to put bands together, write and record. And, you know, I think everything happens for a reason. And we always had a good outlook on things, and it made us better musicians, better songwriters, better producers, better everything. And,
did you think about making a Trickster grunge record?
Not at all. No. It was very 93 when I bought my house and built my studio. Was when we knew, and we did the Undercovers record, which we'll talk. Right. We talk a lot about in the acoustic show. It was a time where we knew the end was near. I definitely did because I had gotten so into singing, being more of a lead singer. And I wrote this, I was writing these songs at that point that were definitely not going to be Trickster. And I had this plan that it was like, I'm going forward. PJ's going to be with me and we're going to go forward with this. And that was the Throne Rocks band, which I remember you coming out to see. Remember you brought that guy from Geffen Records to see us, Benji Gordon. And we were young enough to where we were going to reinvent ourselves. We weren't going to continue doing this. We were so blessed with our career and to be a part of what I consider the greatest era of rock music ever created, the greatest times of our lives. And we're in the history books because of it. You know, we have no, and at that time, we were just so young and we were going, we're musicians. We weren't rock
but
stars.
But you know as better, as well as anybody, that there were, yes, you could do the, attempt the reinvention thing, but the minute an A&R guy sniffed out, oh, wait a minute, that's one or two of the guys from Trickster, forget it.
So it happened, and as we were there making
Skid Row became a band called Ozone Monday.
We were at their
with
showcase.
With a different singer and made demos that were really good.
They
and
were
opened
great.
Shows for, I think, Kiss
they
under
did.
That name.
Yep.
And it was great stuff, but everyone quickly realized that's all Skid Row with a different singer.
Well, we did just that, too. I mean, we got so close with some of these bands that we started. We almost got signed to Sony. We almost got signed to Columbia, I think. I mean, we had,
it was all.
We were there. We kept knocking, and we got so close until they found out who it was, and it just wasn't.
It's so ridiculous
just the two
to
guys.
Think about,
that
but
was,
it's true.
That was always, oh, man, I remember one guy saying, I can't sign the two guys from Trickster.
Right. Yeah.
I was like, you motherfucker. I said, listen to the music. Throwing Rocks, Soaked, 40-Foot Ringo. 40-Foot Ringo was the closest that we got. And it was, man, we still had that cloud over our head. And then at that point, it was like a couple years later, I just threw in the towel. I said, fuck this. We're putting Trickster back together. We're going back
well,
out
exactly
and having fun.
Exactly what Skids did and everybody else. It's like, well, go where your bread is buttered and go do it.
Yeah.
But there were other people that went in, like that went under the radar and tried to beat somebody and almost like be incognito. Like Jason Bieler had some band after Saigon Kick. I'm trying to remember Supersonic or Super something that put out a record that was really cool. Like there was some of that going on too, where it's like, isn't that the guy from like Butch Walker?
Butch, of
becomes
course.
Marvelous Three was South Gang.
South
basically
Gang.
All becomes Marvelous
Love
Three.
Love that band,
and they're doing stuff again now. Marvelous Three, but that was I think Marvelous Three was everybody from South Gang except like one person, the singer or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and they did get signed. So it's really interesting when you look at how everybody handled this whole period. Super Transatlantic. Thank you, Joel. Adam in Wisconsin. Go ahead, Adam.
Oh, hi, Eddie. Hi, PJ. Steve. Very nice to talk
to
you.
Hey, buddy. Hey,
PJ,
man.
I saw you with Fozzy about 3 months ago back in Green Bay when you did that gig with Ugly Kid Joe. It was a great
set. Oh, yeah.
If you guys ever need a good, you know, venue to go to, you know, because a lot of bands don't come north of Milwaukee, you know, the Epic Event Center is a great venue to go to.
Oh, it's the best.
We've all been there. It's a great venue. Green Bay.
Hands and Ryan.
So,
Ryan, yeah.
My subject band today could kind of also fall into bands that should have been huge. And I could go at a ton of different directions, you know, albums I like, you know, Winger, White Line had a cool record in 92 with Main Attraction.
Main Attraction. But, that's a good one. Yeah, that's Richie Zito did that record. That's a great sounding record, too.
Yeah.
Final White Line album.
Yeah, I love that version of Broken Heart on there. I love it more than the original.
There's a song, Adam, I've, as most people know, I have huge history with those guys. And actually, at that time, I was working for their management company when that third record, technically fourth record, came out, A Main Attraction.
Yeah. Is Radar Love on that?
No, mm-mm. It's on the previous one.
That was
one,
Big Game.
Right, but what is on Main Attraction is a song that, in my opinion, should have been the biggest hit White Lion ever had, called Love Don't Come Easy, which is like a hook on top of hook and phenomenal song. And yeah, of and course, it that, because it came out on that dead, you know, nothing happened.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Greg and James left. They went out on the road. They played to no people. They had substitute bass and drums. And then the whole thing ended. I'm sorry, Adam. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was kind of cutting in there, too. But the band I wanted to spotlight today is The Almighty, which includes Ricky Warwick. Been on your band a bunch of times. And they never really made much of an impact in America that I know of. I know they toured a lot in England and Europe, and you can see them on like the MTV special for Monsters of Rock in 92 or 93 with Wasp and Slayer, and they worked with all of them. But they had a record in 1996, I want to believe, and it's called Crank. And I would put that right with Subhuman Race, where it's so heavy and it's just, it hits the spot anytime you're doing yard work or anything, you know, heavy, you know, that you need something to pump you up. There's a song on there that I listen to at least once a week called Jonestown Mind that I love that song so much. It's heavy, it's punky, it's in your face. But their first couple records were a little more in the cult Guns N' Roses vein, but they're fantastic records. Blood.
Yeah, no, I.
And Soul yeah, Destruction.
Yep, Adam, got to go. Thank you. I think when you're talking about a band like The Almighty, it's a little bit of a different thing, though, because they didn't have pre-success. You know, they didn't have success before Nirvana. They didn't have success at all in America. So that really just falls into the what we usually do with bands that should have been huge. I don't think it really fits what we're talking about here.
Not a qualifier.
Yeah. Andrew in Philadelphia. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Eddie.
Sure, man. Go ahead.
I just got a handful here. I want to shout out The Crimson Idol by Wasp. I think that's probably their best album. That came out in 92. And also the follow-up to the first Vane album, Vane, All Those Strangers, and Move On It, from 91 and 93. Really good continuation of, if you like that first Vane record, I mean, these next two are really solid.
I remember, I love Vane. And I love the No Respect album. And I was working at the label. I was working still at Megaforce. And I remember we had Anthrax, who were distributed by Island and on Island at the time, which is the label that had signed Vane. And I remember going up to Island Records for something for Anthrax. And thank you, Andrew. Island Records at the time was floor above Tower Records, 4th and Broadway in New York City. I remember going up there, and somebody in marketing or whatever knew I was a fan of that first Vane record and gave me an advance cassette of the second record with the Island logo and all that, All Them Strangers, and listened to it in the car going back to Jersey. I'm like, wow, this is killer. Can't wait for this to come out. It's not coming out. So finally I called the guy who gave me the advance cassette like a few months later. I go, hey, what's the release date on that record, that second Vane record you gave me the advance on? And he goes, there is no release date. We dropped them. And I go, you what? I go, what do you mean? You give me an advance cassette. The record's done. He goes, no, we dropped them. We're not putting the record out. I go, why? He goes,
stop the bleeding.
Nobody's going to buy a Vane record in 92 or whatever it was. I was like, wow. So that was records that were done that the label just bailed on and you know, just ate it because they just knew they didn't stand a chance. Joey in Illinois. Go ahead, Joey.
Hi, guys.
Joey.
So I don't really have a record. I just wanted to say hi to Steve and PJ.
Hi.
I've been going around, touring around with you guys, helping carry along gear and stuff.
Joey.
Is this somebody you know?
Yeah.
Are you on the road? Are you here?
We're getting punked. We're getting punked right now.
Oh, is this what's going on?
Yeah. We'll see you guys later, Mackenzie. Where's Uncle Ben? And Joey. Yeah.
All right, Joey. I hate to run, but we got a billion calls here, so I can't spend too much time. But thank you, and enjoy carrying their gear. Mm-hmm. Here's Don in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada.
Eddie,
go ahead, Don.
Birthday.
Thank you, Don.
Yeah, great to hear the guys from Trickster again. I miss those MTV days. They had some great videos, great albums, and
they were cute boys, weren't they? They were cute Jersey boys on their bikes, riding their dirt bikes and playing in the garage in their flannel. PJ had the hair flip down at the time.
Nailed it.
Had it nailed.
Right, totally memorable. I kind of followed the trend too and started getting into the plaid after seeing those videos. But I was going to say that, you know, I kind of missed the way the 80s disappeared and the grunge came in. I was never a Nirvana fan, but I really embraced Alice in Chains and Soundgarden. I think they
Don, let me jump in real quick because you will be able to give us a different perspective on this. So
you
being
bet.
That you are from Canada.
I am.
In America, it was literally, we're calling this the Great Wall of Nirvana, thanks to my friend Izzy, that's his title for it, but that gate came down and it was swift and it was abrupt and it was brutal and it just annihilated everything before. What did that happen in Canada? What was the impact of Nirvana in Canada?
Nirvana, it kind of changed the music, just not to such a greater extent. We had bands on the horizon like Nickelback started coming on the scene, still Bryan Adams and that. And with Canadian radio, you have to have a certain amount
of content law.
Content.
Yeah, right.
That still ruled the airwaves. But on the mainstream rock stations, you'd get maybe a handful of songs in heavy rotation. You get like Even Flow and that from Pearl Jam and the Nirvana one or two hits, but it didn't do quite what happened in the U.S. It didn't really shut things down.
Yeah, and that's it. That's an interesting part of it. And thanks, Don. I'm just moving quickly here because we get as many people in as we can before we have to end. But that's the interesting part of it is for people that don't know, in Canada, there is a content law that the radio stations in that country, the terrestrial radio stations, must play a certain percentage of Canadian artists to this day.
Yep.
So it benefits homegrown Canadian artists. So in some way, that would have protected the Canadian market a little bit against the backlash that happened in America because they still had to. There weren't a lot of Seattle-sounding bands from Canada.
We should have had that law about Seattle.
At least in the tri-state area.
Right. Here's Al in Jersey. Go ahead, Al.
Hey guys, how are you?
How you doing, man?
We're good. Jersey is Vegas,
man?
Right now with the three of us.
Yeah.
Jersey has come to Vegas.
The Garden State in the desert.
Yeah.
Listen, I want to thank Steve and PJ because earlier this year I went up to WDHA and they were walking out and they took a picture with me and they signed my WDHA hat and gave me the guitar pick. So I want to thank
you. All right, I remember you.
That's really nice of them because usually they blow right by people and they don't even let you look them in the eye.
No, I remember we actually put them to work. We're like, hey, you're here. We got to do this vid drop for a show coming up.
Oh, that's
here,
right.
Hold
yeah.
this camera and film us. Yeah, we got to do a promo video. Yeah. We put them to work.
Thanks, Al. Good guy.
No
thanks,
problem,
buddy.
Man. Somebody mentioned it before, but I'm going to, it warrants the mention again. I'm going with Dokken's Dysfunctional. I think that's a great reunion album by them. It came out in 94 in Japan and then 95 in the U.S. And, there's a song on there, Hole in My Head, man. When I first heard it, I honestly thought it was King's X. I mean, it sounded like they were listening to a lot of King's X and the Beatles with their harmonies on an album. I think it's a pretty phenomenal album. So,
did that album have Too High to Fly on it? Was that the single?
Yes, it had that one as well.
Yeah.
I think it's a... And it had a cover of From the Beginning by ELP, which was really cool.
Right.
And just, I'm going to play a little impromptu something trunk real quick. What was the album that knocked Nirvana off the top of the charts?
Was it Slave to the Grind?
No.
No.
Oh, because that would have been before, right?
Yeah.
Slave to the Grind was the first number one metal record. Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a hint.
Knocked it off, what? Knocked it out of number one? Was it ever at number one?
Yes. And Steve Brown.
I don't know.
Steve Brown playing in this band.
Steve Brown knocked Nirvana off the charts?
Well, he wasn't on the album, but he played.
Oh,
it was a Def Leppard.
Wait, it's a Def Leppard record?
Adrenalize,
Def Leppard.
That album knocked Nirvana's Nevermind off the number one spot.
That's impressive.
Well, Nevermind had probably been out at that point a year or so, right? Like, it probably was kind of
Yes, it built up to number one, but then when Adrenalize came out, it ended up knocking it off the top of the charts. So the irony is there.
We were all hoping at that point. It was like, this nightmare is over. Def Leppard's going to save all of us. Def Leppard Adrenalize is going to be the record that's going to bring back the 80s, man.
You know, I was just thinking about like huge bands and how they weathered that storm. What year was Balance?
95.
What year was For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge?
91.
91. So so Balance is the only Van Halen album after The Gate, and it shows, because that album is, if there is such a thing as an overlooked Van Halen record, right. Balance is that.
A great record. But
yeah.
You know what's a cool story about how, let's say, bands got along? So here it is, 91, the For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge Van Halen tour. Alice in Chains is the opening act. Now, we're good friends with the Van Halen camp. We went to shows, and we became good friends with the Alice in Chains guys. So we all got along. You know, Alice in Chains was part of the 80s hard rock scene. Like a lot of those bands
that
morphed.
They opened for Skid Row.
Right. They morphed into, they also opened for Poison, too, yeah. Alice in Chains.
Right before we did.
Before we did in 1991. So it was a really cool time, because it was like, man, I remember vividly that we were backstage, and me and Jerry Cantrell were in Eddie's pit and playing Ed's guitar, and me and Jerry were just in Guitar World together the year, you know, a couple months before. And he's like, hey, man, you got more pictures than I did. I go, well, the roles are reversed now because you're opening for Van Halen. But I remember at that gig, we were all there, and Lane Staley goes to the crowd, all right, all you trickster-loving motherfuckers at the Meadowlands.
Wow.
And it was so cool. Wow. But those guys are great, like a lot of the bands. And now, 30 years later, when we see whatever bands, you know, some of the Soundgarden guys, some of the STP guys, you know, we know Robert and Dean DeLeo, the Jersey guys, we're all friends. There's no bitterness, and I don't think there ever was any bitterness with the bands, you know, besides the Metallica Winger thing, which I think was just a bullshit thing. It was, anyway. But
here's Jimmy in Ohio. Jimmy, go ahead.
Time to rebuild my trickster collection.
Hey. Yes, and that's the attitude.
Eddie must have been reading my mind, because I wanted to ask you guys before I get to my album, have you ever done anything with Butch Walker? I thought I heard something that you did.
No, we never did. Just Butch is a friend, and you know, of course, man, what a career he's had as a producer and a writer, and really just so happy that he's back with Marvelous 3. And you know, I'm good friends with his manager, Jonathan Daniel, you know, that we know him, his history.
If you want to know Jonathan's story, watch that Paramount Plus documentary that's on I Want to Rock, because he was in bands himself at one point.
But no, we never worked with Butch, but definitely, you know, Marvelous 3 was an influence for me as a songwriter, as far as going that atomic, you know, sort of atomic pop rock thing, you know, supercharged
power
cheap trick that we did with Soaked and with 40 Foot Ringo especially. So love Butch, super, super talent.
Jimmy, give us your record or your band.
Okay, so I'm going to go with Warrant Ultraphobic. Love that album. It's heavy. It's melodic. I just love that album. It was after the grunge thing. But Eddie, I wanted to ask you about another album, Army of Anyone. Do you remember that?
Yeah. So that was Stone Temple Pilots. That was Robert and Dean with Ray Luzier on drums. And
yes.
Richard Patrick, I think. The Patrick brothers, one is the actor from Terminator, and the other is the singer from Filter. I always get them, Richard and Robert. I get them confused.
They're brothers.
Brothers. Robert's the actor. Richard's the singer.
Richard Patrick.
You never knew they look exactly alike.
Yeah. So Army of Anyone was STP. What was Robert and Dean with Ray and Richard?
Yeah.
And I actually interviewed. And I actually
every
interviewed
song
them.
On there is awesome.
I actually did a TV interview with them for VH1 Classic. Before I was doing that metal show, the stuff I was doing there before. And whenever I see, I actually was at a show and STP were, thanks Jimmy, STP was playing on a festival and so was Korn, and Ray Luzier plays drums in Korn. And I was talking to Robert and Dean and Ray came over. I go, Army of Anyone reunion, look, we can do it, you know? But that was later though. That record was like 04, something like that. That was definitely not... that well past that time.
Yeah.
And STP, Robert and Dean did that because they were having so many problems with Weiland.
Yeah, STP was on a hiatus.
They needed to figure out what else to do and get with another singer. Here is Monica in Phoenix joining us. Hi, Monica.
Oh, hey, Eddie. Oh, my gosh. I didn't think I was going to make it. Hi, PJ. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I'm Monica.
Are you near Flagstaff?
I'm in Phoenix.
Oh, how far is that?
Two and a half hours?
Yeah, it's not too far.
Well, they'll give you gas money if you go see them on Saturday in Flagstaff.
Maybe you can shoot a promo video for
us. By the way, that's a lot of money these days, gas money. That could be $200.
Sure. All right. I might just go up there, but yeah, I'll
there you go.
Hope so. Show, guys.
Okay, you buy a ticket for $20, they give you $200 in gas. You're way ahead of the game. You're pocketing some big money there.
It's a win-win.
Yeah. That's get a voucher.
Okay, one of the first bat. Okay, you guys, everybody knows Firehouse, of course, but I like their "Hold Your Fire" from '92. I thought was great, and a couple people already called in. Some of the ones I had on my list, but I also Wildside from '92, "Under the Influence." I don't know if you guys. I guess.
Well, that's my good friend Brent Woods. Brent's one of my best friends, and that was his. That record was recorded at 5150.
Yeah, I remember.
At Eddie Van Halen's studio. There's a lot of people that. So here's a funny story. Thank you, Monica. Here's a funny quick story. So the Guitar World magazine, in like 6 months ago or less, did a story, and they called it like the 10 best. I think they used the term I hate hair metal, but they said something like the 10 best hair metal records or something that. You never heard of that you should know about. And one of the records in the 10 was the Wildside record.
Yeah.
And they went on and raved about the guitar playing on the record and credited it all to the other guitar player on the record. They never mentioned Brent. So I took the story and I go, hey, I got good news and bad news for you. He's like, what? So I send him the screen grab of the story. And I go, but they never mention you playing guitar. They mention the other guy playing, you know, how great his playing is. And Brent goes, that's really funny because I played all the guitars on the record and that guy didn't play a note. And I was like, oh, my God. So I even connected him with the writer and he's like, oh, man, I want to interview you and fix this or whatever. But he didn't care. It was just because he's so past, you know, not thinking of that. But, yeah, there's people, a lot of people love that Wildside record. I've heard a lot of people bring that up. Let's see. We get one more or two more in before we got to call it. Here's Wes in Wisconsin. Go ahead, Wes.
Hey, guys. Pleasure to talk to all of you. Happy belated birthday, Eddie. And by the way, one of favorite moments of your 40-year career is when you interviewed Steve, probably the night before he was set to fill in for Phil Collin. I think Phil's son was sick maybe or something like that or was just being born or what have you. And Steve gave us a huge backstage look at how he fits into Def Leppard and just some stories about the guys and stuff. And they're my favorite band. So I was hanging on every word. I remember sitting in a parking lot, just listening with bated breath to everything. So just wanted to throw that out.
Cool. Thank you, Wes.
Yeah, of course. I didn't listen. I was in and out of the car for the first hour of the show. I'm not sure if this was mentioned. I guess the first two bands that come to mind always for this topic are Winger, Pull, and Warrant, Dog Eat Dog. But the third band I'm going to throw out there is, let's fast forward about 8 more years forward, the Black Crowes, Out of Nowhere with By Your Side.
My favorite Black Crowes album.
Oh, yeah.
We went to see
By Your Side's
year.
My favorite Black Crowes album, top to bottom. Yeah.
Stop Kicking My Heart Around.
Yeah, Kevin Shirley did that record.
Go Faster, By Your Side, Horsehead, Heavy, Virtue and Vice, just solid album out of nowhere.
I
great
love,
record, but it wasn't feeling the repercussions of Nirvana.
It didn't. Yeah, Black right, but Black Crowes
wasn't hit by the wall.
Yeah, Black Crowes were not part of the scene that the wall took them out, so they could have. But By Your Side is probably my favorite Black Crowes record. It's an amazing album, and interestingly, the only Black Crowes album where Rich Robinson plays all the guitars. Because in the past, there was always another lead. Rich played all the guitars on that record, actually. Well, there are so many more bands and records we did not get to in that segment, in that two-hour show. But we gave you some of them with Steve and PJ here on this week's podcast. Again, if you are a SiriusXM subscriber, listen to full shows, interviews, anything you want, audio, video, and more, by going to the SiriusXM app, punching in my name, or Trunk Nation. If you're in the U.S. and Canada and you'd like to join us on SiriusXM and you are not a subscriber, well, you can get a free subscription right now. Go to SiriusXM.com/EddieTrunk. 3 months free on the app or over the radios. No credit card required. So please come on board and join us for Trunk Nation Monday through Friday, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, live on Faction Talk 103 or anytime on the app. Be sure to follow me on social media at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook page. EddieTrunk.com is the website. Have a great week. Hope to catch you on the radio. If not, catch you back here next Thursday for another episode of the podcast.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy, only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.